one of my favourite pursuits at the farm is, well, not the pursuit of bees, but it's certainly the robbing. It's a dreadful word. The borrowing, I like to think of it. The borrowing from their hives. We're talking about insect philanthropy here. And, you know, I know all our bees by name, so I love this story coming up. The original Democrats, those ancient Greeks, thought honey was the nectar of the gods, but Thomas D. Seeley, my next guest, thinks that honeybees could teach us a thing or two about democracy. Thomas is professor and chairman of the Department of Neurobiology and Behaviour at Cornell. And he's also a keen beekeeper, and he's been studying the little critters and their behaviour for 30 years. And I am going to reveal, or we shall reveal together shortly, some amazing facts that will go against your beliefs about bees. He's written a couple of scientific books on their habits, but his newie is aimed at a wider audience like us. And it is called Honey Bee Democracy. And Tom's on the blower from Ithaca in New York State to discuss it. Tom, welcome to Late Night Live. Is there a honey run on at the moment?
Good morning, Philip, or good evening to you. It's my pleasure to be on your program. No, we don't. Our honey flows are over for the year. All of the bees have tanked up their hives and are ready for winter.
Well, ours are on at the moment because all the blossoms out and the crops are blooming. You know, it's wonderful. Tom, tell us a bit about your experience with bees as a scientist and as a beekeeper. And what attracted you to them in the first place?
I think what attracted me in the first place, Philip, is the smooth functioning of a honeybee society. As you know, when you open up a hive, you look inside, you see lots and lots of individuals working calmly and steadily together. No fighting. The only fighting occurs every once in a while between the queens, when a colony has multiple queens and those queens are sorting it out, killing one another to see who's going to inherit the nest.
I was hinting to the listener at the beginning of the program before we phoned you that the beehive is not really a monarchy. That's a misreading of what goes on. In fact, it's closer to a republican model. Tell us what the queen does apart from laying squillions of eggs.
Yeah, you're quite correct. The honeybee colony really is a democracy with the power vested in the workers. The queen, she has evolved not to be a decision maker, but to be an egg layer. She is the heart of the genetic heart of the colony. She's the mother of all the workers. But in terms of controlling the colony's activities, she does not do that. That is spread among the workers.
Is it true that she manages 1,500 eggs or so a day?
Yes, that's right. That's right. A colony will have up to about 30 or 40 or 50,000 bees, and knowing that each worker bee lives only 30 days, if you go through the arithmetic on that, you find that a colony needs to produce about 1,500 workers a day, and so that's the number of eggs that are laid each day
now,
at the peak.
A colony of bees has to find a new home about once a year, late spring, early summer. Tell us what goes on, because this demonstrates the democratic nature of bee behavior.
Yes, this house hunting process is probably the most remarkable thing that the bees do. It goes on, once a year, a colony, usually in the early summer, when a colony's become very strong, it fissions. And the old queen, the mother queen, leaves with about two-thirds of the workers. They zoom out, they swarm out of the hive on a nice day, and they haven't yet chosen where their new home is going to be. So they first fly, after flying out, they assemble into a ball of bees, a cluster of bees that usually assembles on a tree branch or in a bush. It's about the size of what I call a soccer ball.
Well, often it looks like a busby of bees. It looks like those helmets that are worn by the people who protect our own dear queen outside Buckingham Palace.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it looks like that. And there they will sit for a couple of days, and they are at this point choosing their new home. And the way this works is out of that cluster of some 10,000 worker bees, a few hundred, and we call them scout bees, fly out and they will search for various home sites. And about of those, say, 200 or 300 or 400 scout bees, 10 or 20 of them will find prospective home sites.
These how far are they ranging in this search?
Oh, they will go out up to 5, 6, 7 kilometers. It's a very broad search.
Right. And what are they looking for exactly?
They're looking for, they have very specific preferences. What they're looking for is a cavity. They're looking for cavities that have a volume of at least 40 liters, so they have enough room in the cavity to build their combs and store their honey. They're also looking for a cavity with a small entrance, only a few square centimeters, maybe about 10. And they'd like it to be, the entrance to be high off the ground so it's safe. And they'd like the entrance to be near the bottom of the cavity and to face south in our climate, probably north in yours, so it's facing towards the sun.
Mm. So how come bees will cop hives that are on the ground?
Usually that's because they've been installed in such hives. Given their own druthers, they very strongly prefer an entrance and a nest that's high off the ground and thus is much less likely to be found by a predator. That's a very important preference for them.
Okay, now the scouts have to make sure that the precious queen, who's rather plump and more sluggish than the others, can make the distance.
Right. And that will, the main thing they do in that regard, once they've made their choice, is they monitor her carefully, because when the decision making is over, the scouts will, which are a small minority of the swarm, will signal to the other bees that it's time to fly to this new location, and including the queen, they will all launch into flight, and they'll monitor the presence of the queen by noticing her odor. And if she drops out because she needs to rest, the swarm will stop flying towards its new home, will disperse to find the queen, and then cluster around her again.
Now, I understand from your splendid text that these scout bees are very truthful. They don't exaggerate.
Yes, that's right. That's a key part of their democracy, that there's no reason, none of these scouts would benefit from lying regarding the home site that she's found. And I should point out that about 10 to 20 of these scouts do find prospective home sites, and they come back and report on them and advertise them. And then the colony has to performs a debate to decide which one it will be their new home. And almost always that's the best of the variety of sites that they found. And during this debate, yes, there is no lying. It's completely honest.
Unlike perhaps academics applying for research grants, Thomas.
Well, in both cases there is a self-promotion process. Everybody puts their best foot forward.
Well, they do more than put their best foot forward. They actually dance.
Yes.
Would you be kind enough to describe to the listener the waggle dance?
Yes, the waggle dance is a very special behavior used by the bees to indicate the location of something of interest. In this case, they're indicating with the dance the location of a prospective home site. And the way the dance works is the bee comes back onto the surface of that cluster of bees and performs a miniaturized reenactment of her flight from the swarm cluster out to the new home site. And this involves the bee walking across the surface of the swarm, waggling her body back and forth. And the direction, the angle that she points when she's doing this waggling maneuver, points the direction, and how long she waggles as she walks across the surface of the swarm indicates the distance.
I understand that 300 waggles is pretty bloody good. 10 isn't too hot.
Right, that's the other thing they're indicating when they're doing the dance, besides location. They're indicating the quality of the site, and how many of these waggle runs a bee performs is her way of expressing the quality of the site that she has found. And it ranges from, yes, from one up to several hundred.
Thomas, have you personally observed this waggle dance?
Oh, countless times.
How do you do that?
It's actually very easy because, thank goodness, this whole debate that they conduct is performed on the very surface of the swarm. So just looking at it, These dancing bees are quite, they're very eye-catching. You can see them easily.
My guest, who's delightful, is Thomas D. Seely. His book, Splendid Tome, Honeybee Democracy, and I'll spare you puns about it buzzing with ideas. And we've already dealt with their honourability, the fact that they don't tell fibs. I like the way you intervened in this protest by preparing ready-made hives you planted in the bees' paths, the scout bees' paths.
Yes, for us, one of the keys to investigating how they conduct their collective decision-making or democracy was to find a location where we could watch the entire process. And because normally what happens is the bees leave their hive, form this cluster, start their decision-making, but they find home sites, as we said, kilometers away out across the countryside in forests or whatever. What we needed was a location where we could watch it, and we do this by going to a small island, Appledore Island, off the coast of Maine. It's 10 kilometers offshore, and it's only about 40 hectares in area. And it has no trees on it. It has no natural homes for the bees. So we can take a swarm of bees out here, put out nest boxes, and monitor activities both at the swarm and at the nest boxes to piece together the whole debate, the whole democratic choice.
Are these boxes elevated?
No, that's one thing we don't do. And the poor bees, we vary their quality by changing the volume of the box and the entrance size of the box. We don't manipulate the height, but the poor bees, they're stuck with what we're offering them, so they do pay close attention to them.
I've noticed that most beehives, clearly in Australia, are painted rather a dull white. Occasionally, however, you'll see a beekeeper who's it does quite a variety of colours. Have you ever observed any colour preferences?
No, we actually haven't explicitly checked for that, but I wouldn't even expect it because in nature, the sites that they're choosing, they're all probably pretty much brown or
brown or gray, yeah. And it's true, is it not, that wild bees have a very high death rate as opposed to domesticated creatures?
Yes, that's part of the mutualism that humans have with honeybees. In nature, there's nobody to take care of them. If they have a drought and they run low on food, they will starve. Beekeepers can help them out in that regard. And that's for the bees, this problem of starvation is particularly severe in their first year when they've moved into a hollow in a tree. They have to build combs, rear young bees, and store away food to get through winter, and that's a real challenge. In my part of the world, only about 25% of the newly founded colonies make it through their first winter.
I find that the world of the small-scale beekeeper is really quite charming. They're often mildly eccentric, but they do love their bees.
Yes, that's right, and it's for many reasons. Part of it is just the sheer beauty of watching an insect society work so harmoniously, but it's also because the bees really put the beekeeper in touch with nature. Every day the blooms are changing, and you can see that as the bees bring back different pollen loads of different colors. You can see some days the honeycombs start to really fill up, and other days things are very quiet. It's a lovely way to be in touch with nature.
Now let's do a segue to the fact that you're a neurobiologist. What sort of insights do or have bee swarms given you into the way primate brains operate?
Well, there's a remarkable, truly remarkable similarity in the basic way that a honeybee swarm is organized to make a decision and the way we now know that primate brains are organized to make decisions. In both cases, the situation is one of both decision-making systems are democracies. In the case of the bees, the units or voters are single bees. In the case of the brain, they are single cells, neurons. And in both cases, there's no higher level individual that has synoptic or broad knowledge of the.
What you're saying is that the human brain is a sort of a hive of neuron bees.
That's right. That's right. And in both cases, these neuron bees go out. They get information about the outside world. Each sensory bee or scout bee or scout sensory neuron reports back. And then there is a contest, both in our brains, if we're trying to decide whether, if we're looking at out at the world and we see a movement, and our brain has to decide whether that movement is to the left or the right, there's a competition among the neurons, those reporting on leftward movement and those reporting on rightward movement, to see which group is going to achieve a threshold level of activity first. And that's how it also works in the swarm. You've got bees reporting on a site to the north or one to the south, and there's a competition between those groups of bees to see which one will first build up a sufficient level of popularity so that site becomes chosen.
Have you ever been unfaithful to your bees and taken a peek into an ant's nest or a termite mound to see what's going on there?
Not into termites. We only have one species of termite up here, but I'd love to. But yeah, ants, yes, definitely.
And I mention that because Tim Flannery who's a friend of ours, wrote quite a nice piece in the New York Review of Books on the social organization of ants' nests. And he's arguing in that, much what you're arguing here, that these little creatures can really teach us an awful lot.
I think that's true. I've used, to the amusement of my colleagues, I've adopted some of the group decision-making techniques of the bees to organize the faculty meetings in my department.
And you're kidding.
No, not at all, because really it is in both cases you have a collective decision-making, a democratic decision-making where the power is spread among the individuals, and the chairman of an academic department is, as anybody, everybody knows, if they're doing the right job, they're a humble leader and not a despot. And ideally, if you organize a department or faculty meeting properly, it's not a hornet's nest; it's a beehive.
Yeah, I'm suddenly recalling when I'm talking to an interesting guest like you, thoughts. Fragmented phantom fugitive thoughts coming to bed. But I remember we did something on this program years ago about nanotechnology and how nanotechnicians planning to produce sub-microscopically small swarms of little robots are also looking at bee behavior and swarm behavior because they want to give their nano bees the same sort of behavior patterns or skills.
That's right. And what's going on there is where all of us, whether we're looking at nano robots or bees or neurons, we're all looking at how you best organize a group of individuals where each individual has only a piece of the total information. How do you organize those individuals so that collectively they make a broad, well-informed, a highly intelligent decision.
And Tom, you've got an urgent job to do. Your country is teetering on the brink of becoming ungovernable.
Right.
You've got to get out there and teach Americans to think and act like bees.
There are a number of things that I look at as I look at my Congress where I wish they would use some of the principles of bee decision making. One is, a most basic one, is to, and the bees have this built into them, to act with a realization that we're all in the same boat together. In the case of the bees, yes, the whole swarm sinks or swims if they, depending on whether they find a proper protective home site. In our country, we're going to all sink or swim depending on whether or not we go bankrupt. And so, a key part of group decision making is setting, getting a mindset of recognizing of the shared interests.
Well, let me go through the lessons that you state in your last chapter.
Thank you.
Which is called Swarm Smarts. Lesson one, compose the decision-making of individuals with shared interests and mutual respect. Lesson two, minimize the leader's influence on group thinking. Lesson three, seek diverse solutions to the problem. Lesson four, aggregate the group's knowledge through debate. And lesson five, use quorum responses for cohesion, accuracy, and speed. Well, that sounds eminently sensible and reasonable.
Thank you. It's what the bees do, and it's what I've... And with a group where the group can see themselves as trying to make decisions for that are really the best for the whole group, these ideas do work. And they apply, as I say, I say that not just in principle, but based on practice.
Tom, now we're winding up. There's an issue I want to raise with you, which is outside our terms of reference, and that's the phenomenon of hive collapse. Thus far, it hasn't hit us in Australia to any extent, but mm-hmm. we're waiting and dreading its arrival. And until this last week, there's been an immense number of theories about exhausting the bees through overworking them, you know, through carting them around to fields, to bees in the sense being canaries in the mines, you know, and warning us of big problems. But this week I saw a report saying that it's now been discovered that we're dealing with a quite specific virus. Are you up to speed on that?
I do follow the work on colony collapse disorder. My take on it is that there is no one cause. It is a combination of the bees being overwhelmed by a of parasites and pathogens, as indicated in that recent report, but also poor nutrition and sometimes pesticides. It's the combined effect of all three of these things that are really creating problems for the bees.
And there may be new problems, of course, with the genetic modified crops.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think there's any indication of that. Probably where we do see it particularly a large problem, is in large-scale agriculture. And this creates problems of large areas of monocultural crops, so that bees don't get a balanced diet if they're brought into a vast area with just one type of plant in bloom. And then they're also often trucked in over great distances. Sometimes there's pesticides. And sometimes the beekeepers, working on a very large scale, can't be on top of the health of their colonies and can't...
And they don't have the same degree of affection for them, do they, as the small scale?
It's a different... When you own 10,000, 20,000, 30,000 colonies of bees, you have a very different relationship than if you're a small-scale beekeeper. It's true.
Tom, thank you for that. And I must say, he writes beautifully, this bloke. Honeybees are messages sent from the gods to show us how we ought to live in sweetness and in beauty and peacefulness. So think about that. Honeybee Democracy, Thomas D. Sealing. Edward O. Wilson says a wonderful book about humanity's greatest friend, Amongst the Insects. On our next, Nelson Mandela's biography is out. I think he tried to apply some bee principles to democracy. And we'll be getting a read on it from veteran South African journalist R.W. Johnson. We'll also find out about the checkered history of weather and climate control. Very odd ideas there. And of course, Bruce Shapiro will join us with an update on that beehive. No, hornet's nest of US politics. Stick around on ABC Radio National for the news, and we will see you later.